It is my pleasure to introduce Mr. William T. Browning. In his 89th year, he has resided in Yoakum, Texas, since 1906. He has served his community well by being in both the Chamber of Commerce and the Rotary Club. He has also aided his community by being a member of the Road Commission, which established the present-day highway system around Yoakum. His life in business rotated for many years around the Browning Men's Store and the Elkins 5 and 10 cent store. At the present, Mr. Browning is writing a biography of his parents, centering mainly around the Civil War and Ku Klux Klan. His views on the era from 1919 until the early Depression, which he discusses, represents the views of the businessmen of that time and locale.
The hardest issue that has ever come up in the Yoakum area, and really in the state of Texas, was the issue of the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan came to Yoakum and organize the people here, and the issue was 100% American. That was following the World War I, in which Germany was defeated. And we, in this area, have many German descendants. And so, they hopped on that as their main issue. Of course, the Klan used different things in different sections of the country as their main issue, but for this area and for Texas, it was 100% American. There were many German descendants in this area. They they classified Catholics as being lacking, as being loyal to the Pope of Rome and not loyal to the United States. And so, in that case, the opposition was the Catholic Church and the German-American descendants. They also took upon themselves the enforcement of what they would call indecencies among local people, and really it was took on the enforcement of the laws or the moral code as they saw it. And the town of Yoakum was divided completely by two sets of people. On one side was the Protestants that believed that the Catholics owed allegiance to the Pope of Rome and therefore couldn't be 100% Americans by that fact. And as I said before, the German descent people, which included the Lutheran Church, they were attacked because they had German blood. And in their attempts to enforce their moral code, and one time they had a parade down the main streets of Yoakum, and they rode a man of German descent who worked in the railroad shops but had married a very prominent Protestant or citizen. But they classified him as disloyal and rode him on a rail down the main streets. They also picked out an engineer on the railroad, on the Sap Railroad, and accused him of cohabitating with a Negro woman. They rode him on a rail down the streets. You can see what kind of an atmosphere that created. It was bitter. They just organized in secret, and everybody that joined was supposed to be in secret, and nobody would know who they were. But at the same time, most anybody could tell which flag somebody had in his pocket. And it went, there was, I'd say that some three-fourths of the Protestants either joined the Klan or were sympathetic to it. And those were the days that the Methodist Church had two services on Sunday, 11 o'clock for the morning service and 8 o'clock for the evening service. The pastor of the Methodist Church at that time didn't join the Klan. And they attempted to chastise him. And they, at one night service, the committee, dressed in the Klan regalia with the hoods and everything, interrupted the Methodist service by marching in and laying a wreath or something at the altar of the church where the preacher was opposed to the Klan or did not join it. So you can see that that made a hot issue. The Klan held several nightly meetings nearby in the country, at which they burned the fiery cross, and they attended in their bedsheets and full regalia. on one occasion, some of the opponents of the Klan made a raid on one of these nightly meetings. The Klan had guards out, outer guards and everything, just like a military organization. And these anti-Klansmen came into contact with the outer guards, and there was a shooting scrape. And I personally, living right in this house, my neighbors, we heard the shooting, and it was over this way. Some of my neighbors, who I knew that their men folks were in all probability at the Klan meeting. Well, these women folks, they were very, very uneasy. They came across the street to me. They saw I was here, and that this noise was down here, and they wanted me to go down there and see what the trouble was, see. Well, I had a certain amount of curiosity myself, so I walked over that way, and right there on East Gonzales Street, in came the procession bringing in the wounded man that had been shot in the affray that I just told you about. And there were good friends, prominent people, you'd be surprised, standing there, standing guard with a shotgun on their shoulders. And they brought this wounded man in for medical attention, took him on down to some private residence and got his doctor to give him attention. There was another night that they had a meeting out here on the road between here and Cuero. And this happened to be a night when they had a thunderstorm and rain. And the opposition to the Klan, they knew that they had a meeting out there, and so what they did, they got roofing nails and strode them on the road from here out to where the Klan met. And when the rain came up, or when they didn't know the rain was coming up, but they did know that the people were coming in their cars. And as they would come in over those roofing nails, they'd get those nails in the tires, and the road out here was almost blocked with flat tires. Cars with flat tires. So you can see that the issue was bound to be hot. And I was not a member of the Klan, and I didn't approve of it. I refused to join. But the Cemetery Association was controlled by Protestants. And they had a man who was a Catholic as sexton of the cemetery, and he was running a bootlegging using a cemetery as a base. Well, the Protestant women were afraid to fire him because he was a Catholic, and they were afraid the Catholics would blame them, see? So they sent somebody to me and wanted me to become one of the trustees of the Cemetery Association. Well, I said, why do you want me to become a trustee of the Cemetery Association? Well, we just want you. Well, why? I don't appreciate the honor, but I would like to know why. Well, this man that came, he says, now I'll tell you the truth. All of the organization out there, the women that run this cemetery, are Protestants. And they have got this sexton out there that is using the cemetery as a base of operations for bootlegging. And they want to fire him, but they're afraid to fire him. And they've selected you because you're not a Klansman. You're not a Klansman, and you can do the job. Well, I took on the authority. So I went out there. I said, do you know that this is true? Yes. Well, how do you know it? Did you ever buy any liquor from him? No. Do you know anybody that did? No. Well, how do you know that he did? That he's doing it? Well, we hear that he is. Well, I said, that's not sufficient proof. So, as I took the job, I went out there to talk to him. And he was so open. And he thought that I was on his side, or I wasn't opposed to him. And he tried to sell me some liquor. And I told him, I said, well, now I'll tell you. I've come out here to relieve you of this job just for that reason. So, and I said, I want to be frank with you. I didn't expect you to try to sell me any liquor, but I came out here to do what, as I said, but you have already made the confession, and you are doing it, and I think the thing for you to do is to quit. And he quit. So I say that's kind of a funny incident, but it happened. Well, after this shooting, that became a grand jury investigation. And the Klan had control of the grand jurors in Hallettsville. They had the control of the sheriff. They had the control of the district judge. And so the investigation was made and no indictment was filed. But Lavaca County is composed largely of Bohemians and Germans. At least those two, the Lutheran Church and the Catholic Church, combined, have got control in Lavaca County. And so what it meant the defeat of the best sheriff that LaVarca County ever had in the election, together with the district judge and every other county officer that was not on the right side. See? So that's how bitter it got. They took control of the Chamber of Commerce, of which I was a member and a director. But they took to control, and they had a little fellow that was secretary of the Chamber of Commerce. He was just a popping off and all. I was chairman of the Highway Committee for the Chamber of Commerce, and we were building roads. And we had a bond issue over here in LaVarca County that we had trouble with the commissioner's court. The commissioner wanted to build those roads by force account instead of letting the contract by bids as the law requires. He wanted to hire his friends, see, and pay them out of the county's money, and I wouldn't let him do it. So I got me a lawyer as chairman of the, I was chairman of the road committee, the highway committee, and I got me a lawyer and went to Hallettsville to file an injunction against the commissioner's court on the spending of that money, that bond money. And when we went in to the courthouse, it was just as though it had been, the news had been carried to every one of those officers, and most of them of which were sympathetic to the Klan. You could have heard a pin drop. They called the commissioner's court together immediately and passed a resolution doing just what we were asking them to do. See? But, you know, the fall election cleaned that commissioner's court, commissioners and county judge, along with the sheriff of LaVarca County and the district judge. And that was the issue. So, is that a good enough story for you? Was organized in 1923 when this issue was hot. Business people were not speaking to each other, and Ed Farmer organized the Rotary Club, and he got in as members, charter members, from both sides. And it was the thing that brought the business people, or the main people in town, together. I, at the same time, as I told you, I was chairman of the Highway Committee for the Chamber of Commerce. And we had the road program that we were trying, we're promoting. And we did it. As I say, the organization of the Rotary Club brought these two forces into contact with each other. And we put across a road program that we really enlisted or joined the Good Roads Association of Houston, which put Ross Sterling on the highway as chairman of the Highway Commission, and then later nominated him for governor. And the race was between Ross Sterling and Moll Ferguson, 1928, and Sterling defeated Moll Ferguson. Now we laid out this entire highway system for this area. It included the building of the road, first highway from Yoakum through Hohan to Gonzales. The next one was from Schulenburg through Harrodsville, through Yoakum to Quero and Kennedy. The next one was from Yoakum through Shiner, Flatonia, and up towards that area. Then the other one was from Yoakum through Edna to Palacios. And another one was from Harrodsville through Hope to Victoria. At that time, there was a fight on between Yoakum and Harrodsville about a road to go to Edna. And what we worked out was one that went both up. See? And at the same time, we got the division engineer's office, which was located at LaGrange, moved to Yoakum. North. Then we told you about the division engineer's office bringing 10 people. Yeah, we brought the division engineer's office from LaGrange to Yoakum, which brought 10 people with it. Today, that setup has been enlarged and improved to where, of the 25 divisions in the state of Texas, it is among the three most modern. And instead of employing 10 people that live in Yokum. It employs upwards of 200. Now, there was something else connected with the Yokum area at that time. Really, Yokum had what the doctors would call a compound fracture, in that the railroad had been built here and employed 1,000 people connected with it. Today, the railroad doesn't employ 15 people. The other fracture was that the DeWitt and the Vicar counties, of which Yokum is on the line between them, those two counties previously produced from 30 to 50,000 bales of cotton. Yokum had 6 cotton gins, a cotton seed oil mill, a cotton compress. Today, there's not 100 bales of cotton raised in either county, and there's not a gin in either county, oil mill or compress. Now, this as I said, Yokum had a compound fracture. One was the 30 to 50,000 bales of cotton, and the other was 1,000 people that worked for the railroad. Now, both are gone. And it was necessary that we in the Chamber of Commerce did something to take the place of those industries that we'd lost. We set about various things. One was we organized what was called a bull circle to improve and enlarge the cattle industry. The other one was we instituted the growing of tomatoes to ship to the northern markets. And this started in 1926. We found that there was a period of about 30 days between the shipping period of green wrap tomatoes from the valley and the starting of the green wraps from the East Texas area. And that gap was what we set about to fill. And so we got experienced growers, and we got everything in connection with it, packers, shippers, and we promoted the growing of tomatoes, the producing of tomatoes, to ship to the northern markets. Beginning in 1926, and it lasted for more than 20 years, the highest number of cars ever shipped in one season. That was for Yoakum, Sweet Home, and Hallettsville being the producing areas. It was 700 carloads of green wrap tomatoes. And the last 7 years, I have the record, the average was something over 300 cars as late as 1949. Now, you ask, many have asked, why did they quit raising tomatoes? Why did they quit raising cotton? And you might ask the same reason, same thing, is why they didn't continue to raise black-eyed peas and lady peas and tomatoes for $250,000 canning plant we got established here. And I'll tell you the answer, the correct answer. The regulation of wages and the generous welfare that the federal government put into effect pulled those farmers that were raising cotton, tomatoes, black-eyed peas, and what have you. I'd say milking cows too. It pulled them into the towns and mostly the larger cities, where that they could make more for doing less or not working at all than they could make on the farm. And that, I think, is the reason that those industries died. Now then, you might ask, what took the place in Yoakum? I'll tell you. The things that took the place in Yoakum was the building of the highway system that I've told you about. At that time, there was bankruptcies from the period of 1928, 1930, and 1932. The bankruptcies were widespread in Yoakum. Two of the three banks had failed. Textan had failed. The flour mill had failed. The marble yard had failed. And Carl Wellhausen reorganized the tannery, Textan, and reestablished that business to where today Textan and the Tandy Manufacturing Company employ 1,500 people in this immediate area, 1,000 of them in Yoakum, the balance in Hallettsville, Gonzales, Quiro, Yorktown, and Moulton. Now, at the low period when we were promoting highways, the population of Yoakum had shrunk by one half. The farm population had also shrunk by one half. And that is what I'd say was the compound fracture. And what the Chamber of Commerce and the business people of Yoakum have done that we've got to yoke them on a better basis than it was before. Now, I'll tell you about the Browning store in that connection. The Browning store, when I came here, we raised, these two counties raised 30 to 50,000 bales of cotton. They had these gins, they had the oil mill, they had this, they had the railroad. And the Browning store was a men's store, 50 by 100. And what now are you going to, how are you going to keep the Browning store going with the population both in the farms and in the city cut in half? And my wife and I decided not by cutting the area to half, but extend the trade territory by advertising. And we conceived the issuance of a catalog twice a year. In March for the spring season, in August for the fall. And we sent that book, 68 pages, to 30,000 homes within an area of 50 to 75 miles from Yoakum. Now, I'll tell you what we did with that book. I wrote that book with Sears Roebuck's catalog at my side. I put a hot shot in every department. As an example, the notion department. I put a 10-cent handkerchief for a nickel without any limit on the amount that you buy. I put a work shoe that we paid $2.90 for $2.98 at retail, and I paid the freight. And I had to buy the, I had to make a contract for 600 pairs of those shoes to even get the $2.90 price. I did the same thing with the blue work shirt. I had to place an order for 50 dozen at a click. And I did it through the various departments on what I considered were the critical items. Now, we paid the postage on orders that amounted to $5 or more. Sears Roebuck didn't pay the postage. So the thing that happened was that upon mailing that book, the first thing would be these customers coming in that had, we had, they'd sent us a mail order. The mail order consisted of about a dozen of those nickel handkerchiefs, a pair of those overalls, a pair of those work shoes, and a blue shirt. Now then, that became statewide. That was the year that Dan Moody had just defeated Jim Ferguson, Moore Ferguson. But Dan Moody had served his second term, 4 years. And then Moore Ferguson came back and ran again. And she ran on the Klan issue. And the voters in this county, they had never voted on any issue except two. One was prohibition, and the other was the Ku Klux Klan. And they were opposed to both of them. So, Moll Ferguson defeated the Klan candidate for governor, who was Felix Robertson. He was the Klan's candidate on a statewide basis. And that was the year that Hoover, a Republican, carried Texas. The first Republican that carried Texas since Reconstruction days, against Al Smith, a Catholic, the Democratic nominee. Now that was the issue. And that's the way it went. They got that home, and they compared it with what they could buy locally. They compared it with Sears Roebuck. They were Sears Roebuck customers. And they also examined the goods thoroughly and saw that it was exactly as advertised. Well, now that first mail order was a loss. And my wife says to me, says, "You can't do that." I says, "Those people that send on those mail orders, I'm hoping that they are from out of town and they're going to come here to buy some goods. And when they come, they'll buy something besides blue shirts and nickel handkerchiefs." Now that is exactly what happened. We'd have customer after customer that would come in that had a mail order and buy with the Bohemian, the old man leading the family, mama next and the boys next, they'd buy a bill of goods. Now, on one occasion, that was after we'd mailed the August catalog, we got a mail order from a customer in Tivoli. You know where Tivoli is. It's further away from here than Port Lavaca. For $271. In less than 10 days, he came in with three or four big boys and bought $300 more. Now what we did, we more than doubled the sales of the best year that we had ever had. We took the Browning store out of the red ink into the black ink. And as I say, we saved the Browning store. There would have been no way to have run a 50 by 100 men's clothing store in a town the size of Yokum without you extended the trade territory and got some additional. Now, I think that fits into this story. It's now then, why did you sell the store? Well, I'll tell you why we sold the store. of 1954, I said to my wife, "Now I'm 71 years old, and you are right behind me with less than 3 years. If I should become disabled or pass away, you couldn't liquidate, you could neither run these stores nor you couldn't liquidate them efficiently. And our son William, who was back from World War II, he was in charge of the Elkins 10 little stores. See, Miss Browning was an Elkins. And so I says, I think the thing to do now that we've got this thing up to a high point, profitable, the thing to do at my age and your age is to sell it." Now, we had reached the point to where that everything was getting higher. Everybody that worked for me wanted more money, and justly so. And they wanted to do less work and all that. So we can't go on extending the trade territory because we can't go over halfway to either Corpus Christi, San Antonio, or Waco. We run into the what you'd call diminishing returns. And so, as far as extending the trade territory, we can't expect that. We've already done that, putting it as far as we can go. Now the only thing we can do is intensify what we're already doing. But at our ages, I think the thing to do is to liquidate them. Well, we liquidated them. We employed a broker in San Antonio to offer this stock as a going concern. And he couldn't find anybody that wanted to operate this type of business in a town of this size. And so, the only other thing we could do would be to liquidate by retail. Now, my wife and I were in New York buying goods for the fall season of 54 at that time. And that is where we made the decision. And there we bought only merchandise that could be sold in the fall season. And we began, as soon as we got home, to clean out everything that wouldn't sell in the fall. And we put on a sale coming in September. If you remember, 1954 was one of those hot, dry falls. It was the drought area. It was the time when the big trees were dying around here, you know. And so we did fairly well. We put on another sale in October. We didn't do so well as we should have done, because the cotton was already gone, and it wasn't cold weather, and it wasn't wet weather. Came November, and we did a little better. We got a little cool, damp, wet weather, in November. And then, up to this time, I hadn't told my employees what my plan was. But now, I called them in, and I told them what I was going to do. That I was going to liquidate the store and quit. And that I was going to pay them a bonus that would stay with me until the end, which would be February the 1st. We put on a Christmas sale in December. And the first thing we knew, the employees' kinfolks, our good friends, began to come in to buy. And that word spread that we were going out of business. And different ones would come to me and ask me and says, I hear that you're going to quit. I says, I've got it under consideration. I didn't tell them that I was. I didn't tell them that I wasn't. And you know that we sold twice as much goods in that December as we had sold the December before, when we had three times as much inventory to sell from. And then when Christmas Eve came, we were down to the nub. We had sold 80% of that inventory out. We didn't have enough merchandise on hand to justify putting on an extensive sale for January. So I sat down on Christmas Day and wrote a letter to two firms that had indicated an interest in the business. We're also having the ads chain of department stores. And they were able to buy and they were able to pay. I wrote them a letter and told them what we had. I told them that we had the best location in town, had been the best location for 50 years. I told them what our sales had been, which were toward $300,000, all for cash, no credit. And I told them what the population was within a radius of 100 miles of Yoka. And I told them what I had and offered that the inventory at 60 cents on the dollar of cost. The cost was 70. That meant taking inventory at 42%. See? And I wrote them this on Christmas Day. The following Wednesday, no, the next day, Kay Willems called me from Corsicana and said that they had a man going down to Corpus Christi Wednesday and would come in and talk to me. Well, on Wednesday, there came a station wagon in town with four men. Two of them went to the bank. Two of them made a survey of the town, of the textan and tannery and the different highway department and all. And at 4 o'clock that evening, two of them came to see me. And I made a deal with them and made a contract and was to start inventorying the next morning at 8 o'clock. And we did inventory at 8 o'clock. We figured it up. And by 4 o'clock, they had paid me for the goods. And they put $5,000 in escrow in the bank for the fixtures and the air conditioning system pending the consummation of a transfer of the lease. The lease had the man that owned the building lived in Anthony, New Mexico, a little town 30, 40 miles from El Paso. But he was in the hospital in El Paso. And I got one of his kinfolks in Anthony to go to El Paso, to the hospital, as a go-between, to talk to the man that owned the owned the building. And I made an arrangement for the transfer of the lease by telephone. And so